From an early age, we're all immersed in sport. For some, it fails to ignite a spark inside us. But for those of us who catch the fire, it's the beginning of a lifelong journey filled with highs and lows, which all matter far more than they should. After all, it's just a game, we're told. Sport is a certainty. It's a point of reference in an increasingly uncertain world. And the bonds formed with either sport in general or a hometown club transcend both time and generations. Today, much of what sport has always meant to true fans has been somehow lost in a blizzard of corporate communications, fireworks, and froth. The attachments that were once so strong seem more trivial in the global age of televised sport as entertainment. What was once authentic has become increasingly staged. In this podcast, we'll get back to the things that sport has always meant to true fans. We'll take you from the boardroom to the dressing room to the pitch, but we'll do it not as a corporate communication, but as true fans of sport, and we'll do it with authenticity. We'll be honest and we'll speak our minds. This is a podcast for true sports fans, and the one thing all fans have in common is a passion for the game. Now, we certainly don't mean to cause any offence, so if you find yourself taking any, just shrug it off and get back in the game, because this is about the game, and the game is bigger than all of us. Welcome, everybody, to a very special edition of Are You Not Entertained? I am here in San Francisco. It's a beautiful day, apart from the fires, which are licking at the city's doorstep. Roger, I presume you are in the lake.
Yes, it's early morning in the lake. The sun is coming up, and I'm pretty good. Yep, great.
Attaboy. Producer James on the rock in the Cayman Islands, and that only leaves one more member of the team. Captain Morgan, wherefore art thou?
Well, I've moved from Wandsworth to Tokyo, where I'm recovering from a weekend of sensational rugby football that has taken its toll.
Yes, it's a shame this isn't a video podcast, because that would be a lot more fun for the listeners to be able to watch you trying to figure out your computer after an epic weekend of rugby slash drinking.
Yes, it's been something of an experience. I left London on Thursday to get to Tokyo, and I did three laps of Japan in an Air China plane, which then had landed in the wrong city. So I was 24 hours late for where I was supposed to be in Tokyo. So literally arrived and was presented with a very large glass of Heineken and started my weekend in earnest, and it finished very, very late last night.
Excellent. Well, now, how did you end up in the wrong city?
Well, I don't speak Mandarin, so whatever the pilot of Air China thought he was doing, I don't think he knew. I think there had been bad weather, so they couldn't land in Tokyo, but we didn't know that at the time. And when we got out of Osaka, it was something of a disappointment and a surprise.
marvelous. Well, I tell you what, we'll leave the travails of Captain Morgan and get onto the rugby, because as you said, Giles, what a spectacular weekend of rugby this has been. And this obviously is a perfect segue into our guest today, which we'll talk about in a second. But do you want to do the Wales thing first, or should we talk about England and New Zealand first?
I think we can talk about Wales very quickly, because it was a really dramatically dull game of rugby, and it was a great shame. And I think it was two sides that were too scared to lose, and therefore the occasion got the better of them, and they were just, it was so defensive. It was palpable that the fear that neither side wanted to lose, and what resulted was, I suppose for the purist, is a game of chess, and eventually one side wears the other out. But as a spectacle, it was disappointing, but perhaps inevitable.
Now, had that game have been played first, do you think it would have looked a little bit better by comparison?
Yes, I think so, because I think for both sides, now knowing as they did that New Zealand were not going to be meeting them in the final, for any side not playing New Zealand, they know that the chance of of immortality and winning a World Cup is that much higher. Right. And therefore, I think for both Wales and South Africa, they knew that whilst England are a wonderful side, it isn't New Zealand. And therefore, if they could get to the final, it would be something of a give them a great option to win, to hoist the cup. And I think that affected the game.
Yeah, it's interesting because I sat and watched that England-New Zealand game at, sort of 1 a.m. And as an England fan in any sport, you're used to watching with your heart in your mouth the whole time. And no matter how well England are playing, you're always convinced that they're going to throw it away, the other team are going to come back. And I have to say, from first minute to last, I mean, I've never seen an England team batter anybody like that. There wasn't one period in that where I felt like they were under threat. It was an extraordinary performance.
It really was. And I've been very lucky in my professional career to go to a lot of rugby matches over the year. And I think France, New Zealand in 99 World Cup was one of the most astonishing games. I was in 95 when Jonah Lomu ran over England. I was the Lions tour in 2009, second test South Africa, where the Lions lost narrowly. These are all great games of rugby, but I do think that was, and I was talking to Martin Johnson in the Hilton yesterday whilst I was still compos mentis, and he thinks that it is the greatest performance by any England team ever in the history of English rugby, including, he was saying, their own performance in 2003, because they were expected to win. They were the favourites. This was an England team that had been on a journey. I think what blew him away, and I think blew everybody away, was that England turned up on Saturday for the semi-final of the World Cup, and they out New Zealand, the New Zealanders. It was almost a perfect display. And I've never witnessed such a dominant performance from a side you weren't necessarily expecting to play that well.
Yeah, I mean, that was, as I was sitting here watching it, I was just thinking, we're absolutely battering them. And that is not something that you expect when you're facing the All Blacks. The All Blacks looked like they had no answer to anything. They were constantly under pressure. They looked flustered. They just never got into their groove. And it was, you kind of had to pinch yourself to believe this was an England team doing this to them.
Well, I think a lot of credit has to go to Eddie Jones, who's obviously masterminded victories over the All Blacks and knows them very, very well over his career. But I think he got an England team absolutely ready for that encounter. And I suspect he's quite relieved that they're not playing Wales, because the emotion and all of the other things that the England-Wales fixture can bring makes it more probably more of a challenge. I think that England will go into this final feeling pretty confident.
Yeah, I agree. Now, the moment it all, there seemed to be something in the air to me, was right at the very beginning, before the match kicked off with the haka. Rog, I want to bring you in for this, because you and I have kind of chatted backwards and forwards on this over the weekend. But what did you make of the way England faced down the haka at the beginning?
We've spoken about the haka also in the first season, and whether we felt it was in some way being diluted. I'll leave that aside for one second. England standing there with those faces reminded me very much of David Soule for Scotland, the way they walked out that day against England before that famous triumph, which our guest may have something to say about. But, my view was, looking at this, I saw those England players and I saw those faces, and I thought, what they're thinking now is, let these guys go through their little, Halloween party piece, which, by the way, by now, I think everybody knows is a little bit of a performance. And we'll get our game face on, and we'll show them what we're all about. And I agree with you, Grant. I think, they started that game on a much better footing than the All Blacks. And I do think it was won, as they say, before the bell sounded round one.
We talk a lot on this podcast about authenticity, right? This has been something from the first moment of the podcast that has been very important to us. And I have to say, over the years, I've loved watching the haka. It's just, there's something about it, or there always has been something about it. But, as I watched the England guys standing there, in their arrowhead formation and kind of creeping over the halfway line, and Owen Farrell smirking at TJ Perenara, I couldn't help but think two things. One was that the intimidation was basically zero. I didn't think they found the hacker remotely intimidating. And the second was that it has become theatre. It's become something that the fans expect to see and people want to watch it. And it just, for the first time, it didn't feel authentic to me. It felt like they were doing it because everyone expects them to do it before a test.
Felt the same, mate.
Yeah, and if that, I don't know what the answer to that is. You know, is it you only do it, you know, I don't know, every now and again? I mean, do they change it and do the can-can every now and again? I don't know but it feels to me like it's kind of lost its beauty. It's lost its authenticity. I was really quite sad about that.
Agreed.
Giles, you were there in the stadium. What did you make of it?
Oh, I love seeing the haka being... I feel slightly differently. I quite like the haka because it's a tradition. But I like the haka when other sides are allowed to do something about it, and there's not this sort of divine right that the haka has to be somehow left alone. I thought that the V formation or the V sign or whatever England were doing was a fantastic, respectful response to the haka, which is two teams about to go into battle. And I think on this occasion, England got it right. I think there's been times in the past, I remember way back in 91, I think, Ireland, Willie Anderson, the Irish all got into a line and they went right up close.
Yeah.
And it was Willie Anderson, I think, eyeballing Buck Shelford, who was then the captain of New Zealand. And there was a bit of an uproar, but Shelford himself, who's a Maori, was very, very complimentary of the Irish and said, "That's fine. We can take that. I think this is about two sides going into battle." So I like the haka, but I love what England did. I thought it set the tone for the game. And my God, those first 10 minutes in particular, England were... there wasn't a scrum, I don't think, for 25 minutes. And England played perfect rugby. It was as a Welshman, it was something you had to kind of pinch yourself and then go, wow, this England team are the real deal.
Well, let's, you know, hearing you say that brings me to the other thing that I wanted to talk about with this particular game, and that is the fact that for me, the game itself, the crowd, the reactions of the players afterwards embodied just about everything that is good about sport. You know, it was two of the best teams in the world competing at a high level, no quarter being given, the fantastic fans, you know, all intermingled with each other, noise, everything you could want. And then at the end, you know, a winner and a loser and respect all around. I mean, it was absolutely... I mean, I can't imagine a better sporting event than that which they gave us on Saturday.
Well, and I also think that those values of sport that you mentioned, I think for kids watching, for parents who are trying to educate their children in the way of the world, you don't have to look much further than a game of rugby like that, where the talent and the hard work of the people who are on the pitch is there to all to see. And the way that they play hard but fair, and then afterwards the respect, I think it's everything you'd possibly want for your children as to understand the sort of the mores of how human beings can interact. I thought it sounds very pompous, that, but I really do. It was mind-blowing how humble the New Zealanders were after the game. I thought the English were very magnanimous in defeat. I think it was just a great display of a great game with great values.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, for me, the thing that always I marvel at in rugby, and, you know, and I grew up, I played football as a kid, but I went to a rugby school. So I played both as a kid, but football was always my first love. But, you know, watching the way the players respect the referee, the way the referee communicates with the players, and then even with the TMO, you know, whenever we had to go to the video replay, we've seen what a complete debacle it's been in the Premier League this season when they've introduced video replays. I mean, the whole thing was just flawless to me. Absolutely flawless.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, Giles. That in fact was the question that Chris Cairns at Smart Sports brought up. Again, technology and sport, TMO. How come it seems to be working in rugby and clearly it's not working in football? How come it can be used in such a way that creates respect? The thing that, as you say, Grant, that astonishes me in rugby is, you know, you get the referee, he's mic'd up, you hear what he's saying to the captains. Sometimes they agree, sometimes they don't, but they just take it and walk away, as does the rest of their team. There's nobody screaming in their face. I don't understand why football can't follow that. But, you know, TMO has been done well in rugby, and VAR is a disaster in football. You know, England this year, they seem to be very surprised about it, but we've seen it in Italy for 2.5 years now. And I was saying to people, trust me, this is a disaster. So what is your guys' view about TMO and VAR, and what needs to happen in the trade-off between accuracy and immediacy?
Well, look, I mean, I think they have got it right in rugby. I think it's perhaps an easier thing to use in rugby. You know, the thing that I have a problem with in football is the offside rule. I'm okay with the checking penalties. I think that's the ones of those I've seen have been okay, but the offside ones where, you know, he's got a toe slightly over the line. I think if it should have to be blatant, not his elbow is in front of the line. I think that to me just makes a mockery of it. But with regards to rugby, we should absolutely put that question to our guest this week. Giles, why don't I let you introduce our guest this week, because it's a cracker.
Yeah, well, our guest this week is a former British Lion and Scotland captain. For a long time, he was Scotland's most capped player, I believe, until his brother overtook him, Scott, probably much to the family disappointment. But I'm delighted to welcome former Scotland and British Lion fullback Gavin Hastings onto the show. Hello, Gavin.
Hello, hello.
Gavin, hi. It's Giles here, and also Grant and Roger.
Hey, Gavin.
Hello, Giles and Grant and Roger. How are we?
Very well, thanks.
We are well.
Good.
It's quite impressive, Gav. We've got someone in San Francisco, someone in Italy, someone in Cayman, someone in Tokyo, and I think you're in Hong Kong this afternoon.
Giles, do you know what's even more impressive?
Go on.
The fact that I left the golf course on the 15th hole.
Had you already won?
Wow.
Or lost?
Yeah, probably. One of those two outcomes. But anyway, that doesn't matter. We're good now.
Where were you playing, Gav?
Out at Clearwater Bay. We're giant.
Oh, beautiful.
The pass. It's really lovely. It's lovely.
Yeah, that's very nice out there. Well, look, thanks for joining us, and thanks even more for walking away from the golf course. I wouldn't have walked away from the golf course for Giles and Roger, that's for sure.
For another reason, it's been pissing down for the last 5 minutes, so it was okay.
Fair enough. Well, now, Kev, we've been chatting off air about the two games of rugby this weekend. So before we go back in time, it'd be lovely to get your thoughts on two splendid games of rugby this weekend.
First and foremost, I mean, I think Saturday's game, you know, England were so utterly dominant against the All Blacks that there's always question marks when you see the All Blacks being beaten, that they look, for me, like an ordinary rugby side. And it doesn't happen very often, but when it does happen, you think, why do more teams are not able to do that? And I don't think I've probably in recent memory seen a team from start to finish be so dominant. And, you know, really, apart from a massive mistake in the English line-out that allowed Servia to score, they were absolutely dominant from first minute to last. And, you know, were certainly good for their victory. There's no question about that. And I think, you know, I, amongst many rugby people, would say, oh, my God, that was a hugely, hugely impressive England performance. And, you know, they were great from 1 through 15 and the subs that came on. And, yeah, good on them. You know, I have to be honest, I think it's great for World Cup that New Zealand are not going to win it. And, you know, I was cheering for Wales last night as well. And in a completely different style of game, I think, you know, they almost pulled South Africa down to the level of rugby that they play. And it was a mighty close affair.
Gavin, do you think that Gatlin made a mistake? Do you think he should have tried to get the guys to go to play wider and to try and sort of go to the corners a bit more? Or do you think he had only one game plan, which was just to try and sort of grind out a victory if they could?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, Wales have probably played a bit like that, Giles, over the last number of months. And I think the loss of Liam Williams from fullback was a massive blow to them. You know, it's just they lose something without Williams being there. He's got a massive, massive presence in my estimation and my mind. I think he just offers something that Lee Halfpenny doesn't, quite honestly. And, you know, I remember back 8 years ago in 2011, Lee Halfpenny was a real quality player, and he was at the peak of his game, I think. But in many respects, the game's moved on, as it so often does. And, you know, we have a barometer to judge teams by when they're all playing in the one place at the same time, and that's obviously a World Cup. And, you know, you just look at the way that the game can be played. And I just honestly think that Wales will wake up this morning and they'll think, my goodness, that was so close. And what you have to understand, and I think people recognise, that sport at the highest level, it doesn't matter if it's a sport that involves one person running 100 metres or a game of rugby involving 46 players. It's a game of margins, okay? Massively tiny margins. And for me, you know, that game turned on probably South Africa getting their try when they did, and almost the first defensive mistake that Wales had made. And up till then, they were, as I say, almost pulling South Africa down to the level and frustrating them. And, you know, you could sense that they made a lot of mistakes and whatever else. And it just wasn't happening for South Africa. And then just one piece of great rugby, obviously, from a South African perspective. And, you know, in the cold light of day, a poor defensive effort from Wales. And that was probably the difference at the end of the day in a game that lasts 80 minutes involving 46 players.
Gav, do you think it's been a good World Cup in terms of the rugby that's been played? Do you think?
Yeah, look, you know, Giles, it's easy to say, you know, I think there's been some terrific games. I think the best team playing the most attractive rugby has probably been Japan, and they were absolutely magnificent. They were magnificent against Scotland. They were clearly magnificent against Ireland. And for 55 or 60 minutes against South Africa, they were absolutely magnificent. And, you know, I would love to see the rugby being played like that all the time. But when you have the giants that South Africa seem to just pick out, and you know, they're playing to their strengths. And rugby is not played to a formula. There's no right or wrong way. It's about, when you get down to semi-finals, quarter-finals, it's about winning games. And, you know, South Africa, for the second final in a year, second tournament in 4 years, they've got to the final, having lost one of their pool matches. And they're able to regroup and recover. And, you know, that's the strength of their character. And Wales were not far behind.
Gavin, we've seen two, say, tremendous games this weekend, and we've seen two defeats which are wholly different. One is, you know, a very close match that could have gone either way, and the Welsh, you know, unlucky to lose, but probably the South Africans deserved it on balance. And then you've seen the All Blacks, who many, as you said, would have expected to win, get thoroughly beaten by an England team. Just, if you can, take us inside the dressing room and help us understand what it's like in a dressing room after those kinds of losses, whether it's an unexpected one or a close game. How's the team dynamic in there?
Let me say, there will be one team, you know, Wales will obviously be so disappointed in the way that they lost that game, because they will feel that they probably contributed to their own downfall in many respects, and you know, they'll maybe never have a better chance of reaching a World Cup final. In a funny sort of way, in contrasting that, the All Blacks, they were never in that game. And you analyse it, they never really had a sniff. The only time they had a sniff was when the Surveyors scored and they kicked their goal, and it was the only time the whole game, and then England snuffed them out really from then. So when you know in a funny sort of way that you're going to lose the game from maybe 20 minutes out, it's you're able to sort of condition yourself mentally that this game, it's just one of these times that you're not going to win. Whereas from a Wales perspective, you know, really up until the last 5 minutes or the last 3 minutes, they would have felt that they were very much in the game. So there's no doubt in my mind that Wales would have been absolutely distraught in that change room. I'm not for a minute suggesting that the All Blacks would not have been, but what I'm saying is that they knew that that result was going to happen before 3-4 minutes away from the end of the game.
Gavin, I think that's such a fascinating point. I love rugby, but I'm more of a football guy. Talking about, you know, that disappointment and the way you've articulated that so well, how come rugby guys at the end can show such decorum, such dignity? And, you know, we've seen the aftermath of these results, how well they conduct themselves. Whereas in my sport, we see that very, very rarely, and we see all kinds of behaviour that you wouldn't want to be proud of. What is the secret of rugby that it can do something like that?
I don't know, history and tradition maybe, but I think the All Blacks are just world leaders in everything that they do, and they always pay tribute to the opposition, and they give them due credit when credit is deserved, and they're very humble in victory as well. And I think they recognise their place in world rugby, that they are a team that many, many people from around the world admire, and they set themselves very high standards, and that goes in defeat as well as in victory. And look, you know, football's football, okay? And I really, you know, I'll talk about football another time, but for me, football is bigger than sport. Football is just football. Sport is sport. Football is. It's just so much bigger than anything else in sport. So I just class football as football, and the rest of us will get on with sport, okay? And because that's the way I feel, because football doesn't have these things. So that's football. That's football's issues. That's football's challenges, you know, but let them deal with it. And really, we'll get on with playing sport.
Gav, your entire rugby career, you're obviously a good young player, then up to university and played for your country, then you played for the Lions as well, and then following your retirement, you've been involved in broadcasting, et cetera, et cetera. And most recently of all, you've now had to watch rugby through the lens of being a parent your lad Adam, who's now playing for Scotland and playing at fly half. How has that changed your appreciation? What's it like being a parent of a rugby player, having been a rugby player yourself? It must be a fascinating and different experience for you.
Well, I think in a funny sort of way, this is the 9th World Cup, okay? And I played in the first 3 World Cups, and it's the first time that you almost feel a sense of achievement, if you like, that here you are 24 years after you retired from international rugby, your son was representing, you know, his country like you were. And you speak as a parent, you don't speak as a former rugby player or someone. I'm there proud as a dad and you know, alongside his mum, my wife. And it's wonderful to experience that. And we've been with other parents, and we go through the same emotions, and we go through the same highs, and we go through the same lows. And you know, when things go well on the field, then you feel incredibly proud. And, you know, you just got to pick them up if things are not going well on the field. And, you know, unfortunately, I think it's a shame from Adam's perspective, and I speak as a parent again, that he wasn't there to experience, you know, going beyond or going into a quarter final, because it's different rugby, it's pressure rugby. It's an incredible environment, and the opportunity, you know, to play as they would have done against the All Blacks would have been another amazing sort of feather in his cap and a huge experience as well for him to do that. And I'm disappointed for him and the rest of the younger guys in the Scotland team that they've not been able to get that opportunity and grasp that opportunity.
Gav, the game's changed a lot, obviously, since you played, and Adam is playing the modern game, which is so fast-moving and physical. Do you talk about the game and developed, or are you able to share more the kind of the emotional side of the physiological, well, philosophical side of the sport, or do you talk, do you sit and talk about the modern game? I mean, for me, it's a fascinating conversation where you played so many times for your country, huge amounts of experience, you know the game inside out, and there's your little boy who's not so little anymore now, you know, taking on enormous rugby players and all the rest of it. It must be, I find it fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of talking earlier a wee bit, you know, earlier in the tournament about, I don't know how many dads who have played in the World Cup are now watching their sons, you know, and this year I reckon there's probably a group of, I don't know, 10, between 10 and 20 maybe, that have played in the World Cup and they're now watching their kids playing. And you know, it's a pretty select group. I'd quite like to create that group and, you know, a World Cup family sort of thing, and it would be awesome, and just to get together and share experiences of other dads, and what it's like, and guys that have played in the World Cup, and how do they speak to their kids. And I don't know, all I know is that my son is pretty independent, and you know, I offer him advice, and you know, I try and suggest things, but I don't overload him with information, and, you know, at the end of the day, I leave it to him, because, you know, 24 years has passed since I last played, and a heck of a lot of rugby and about the game has changed a heck of a lot as well. So, you know, I think I'm wise enough and sensible enough to understand that, you know, it's a completely different game, and you can offer some fatherly advice as opposed to, you know, some rugby advice.
Gavin, I'd like to follow up on that one, because I just find that fascinating. I'll give you my point of view on this. Again, in that other game that's not a sport, football, the father-son thing doesn't happen that much. The only one that I can really think of is the Maldini family, Paolo Maldini and his father. And Paolo always said that he found it incredibly difficult because everybody thought that he was getting a fast track, and he always felt, you know, the unspoken looks of, well, you're only there because it's him. Tell me a little bit, did your son ever sense that some element of resentment, some element of, well, you really shouldn't be here? And if he did, how did he deal with that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think the best thing I did was send Adam away from Scotland, and you know, he was doing well at you know, and was a relatively big fish in a small pond, and he went down to England to the famous Millfield School for 2 years on a scholarship, and I just remember going down there on a scholarship day a number of months before, well, probably 12 months in advance of when he was going to start, and I said, I'm only going to ask you one question. And I asked him the question, do you see yourself being at school here? And that was the only thing that mattered, because it wasn't about me. It wasn't about what I wanted to do. It was about what he was prepared to do. And I just felt that the education that he could have, not only in rugby terms, but also in just in growing up and understanding that people south of the border are not your enemies, but they're there to be respected. And, you know, you just get on with people the same as you do in your own country, and you know, until you experience that, until you go away from home, until you're on your own, until you're left to your own devices without having the parental comforts of that, then you don't know what you're going to do and you don't know how you're going to react. So it was up to him, and then you know, he was lucky enough to get signed up on an academy contract by Bath, and you know, he made his debut for them, and you know, you just learn and you pick up these experiences. And I think the 4 years that he had away from home between sort of 17 and 21 was almost the making of him, quite honestly.
Gavin, all we need now is for you to somehow imbue the same sort of qualities in Roger about getting on with the people south of the border. That would do us all a big favour. But talking about the game itself and going back in time, To the time when you played, you know, I've seen clips of old England teams with Beaumont and Carling, and I remember at the World Cup final in 2003, I remember Neil Back had to change his shirt, and here's a guy playing flanker, And I remember what the flankers looked like when I was at school. And Beck sort of took this torn shirt off, and it was like the cover of a bodybuilding magazine. It was absolutely ridiculous. You know, when you look at the game today, the condition of the players, the size and the speed of the players, do you wish that you were playing in the modern age? Do you think it would be, you know, a great challenge to play in this new age of rugby, or are you happy that you played in the time that you did?
Well, you can't wish your time again, and you know, there's no doubt that what I think is great about rugby, the sort of the guys are, you know, they're pretty high profile now, and they take care of their bodies, and they, you know, it's wonderful to play at the highest level, and I think that it's always been that way, and yet, of course, with every successive Rugby World Cup, it's bigger than the previous tournament, and I think that the fact that it's come to Japan has been brilliant for this part of the world, and I think that the Japanese have absolutely embraced it, and I think they put on a tremendous show, and you know, you've got to desire to perform at the highest level, and I played in the first three World Cups, as I said earlier, and I was proud of the way that I played in those World Cups, and I know that I played pretty close to the best of my ability, because they only come round once every 4 years. I'm still the second highest point scorer in World Cup history. That's pretty something to be pretty proud of, and you know, I look back and I go, well, I performed at the highest level here and to the best of my ability. That's pretty good. And, you know, that's what you want to be. You don't want to have any regrets. You don't want to be complacent about anything when you're playing there. And you just want to try your very best and do your very best. And then there's plenty of time for looking back. And, you know, I think I'm lucky that I'm able in this World Cup to have watched my son. And I just want him to work out what he wants from the game, you know, and if I can help him become a better player by, you know, asking these questions, then who knows, we might just challenge the attitude of him and some of his colleagues who, let's face it, have not performed to the best of their ability in this World Cup, as far as the Scottish perspective is concerned.
I'd like to ask you quite directly. I'm of the generation that, you know, remembers Jim Rennick and Andy Irvine, and obviously yourself, i.e. before professionalism. And I would suggest, in my own mind, there was a net difference between the magnificent sport of rugby union and that sport that I watched unwillingly before the football results came up at the end of the day on Grandstand Rugby League, which I found a bit drab, to be honest, compared to the kind of things that you would see in a rugby field from somebody like a David Duckham. Would I be being controversial to say that rugby union has morphed into rugby league post-1995?
Well, you could say that a lot of the skill sets that you know, the players have now, and you know, the game is not vastly different. We all know that. There's a lot of similarities in the two games, and you know, both codes have their massive followers. So, you know, I don't think they'll ever become one game if that's what you're aiming towards. I just don't see it. There are just
no, not at all. The opposite, Gavin.
Say again, sorry.
I'm just saying the opposite. I lament it a little bit that when the players perhaps didn't have that physicality and maybe that overall fitness, that the skill levels were on display were higher, and you saw the kind of breakouts and the kind of skills in the back row that I think you see less and less of these days.
Well, I probably beg to differ with you, to be honest. I think the skill levels that we see on display a lot of the time in top-class rugby are amazing. And, you know, but ultimately it's a team sport, and one person's skill contributes to a try. And, you know, that's the same in so many different sports, and probably above all in soccer, when a Messi or a Ronaldo can do amazing things. and win a game, it's probably a bit less likely that an amazing player on his own can win a game because there is so little space. That's the thing I lament about rugby, is the lack of space for great players to showcase their skills. It's all, in the first instance, about power and precision, and then trying to unlock gaps and whatever else. But there are many people who are paid a lot of money to try and fundamentally find holes in the opposition defence. And I don't bother with too much time about thinking about all of that. I enjoy the camaraderie of rugby. I enjoy going to the Rugby World Cups. I enjoy watching the game. I enjoy having a beer and speaking to my mates about it. And that's what I fundamentally enjoy about rugby. I'm not going to get in. We'll leave all the precision and whatever to the coaches.
Gav, there was a lot of camaraderie over the weekend up in Tokyo. It's all set up for you beautifully when you arrive on Tuesday. I can confirm that already. Looking back on your own career and whether the game's moved on as it has and it's changed, you had a long career with Scotland and the Lions. If you had to single out one performance or moment in your career that you would say is your own personal highlight, what would it be?
That's quite a good question from you, Giles. I wasn't expecting that.
I've been quiet for 10 minutes thinking about it, so it took me a while.
I think on a purely personal basis, we had not won in Paris for 26 years until we happened to win in 1995, the first time ever in the Parc de France. And I think, you know, I look back at that game and I cajoled and convinced my team that we were good enough to win and play good enough rugby to win that game. And you know, we managed to achieve it at the end. I was lucky enough to score the last minute try to get that victory. But, you know, as importantly as that result was, for me, the party afterwards was up there with one of the very best parties I've ever had in the game. And you know, people say, what would you like to see from your career? I say, I'd like to see a video of what we did that night, because I've got no recall whatsoever.
Gavin, I have to ask, as the token Englishman in the conversation, I have to take you back to the 1990 Calcutta Cup. You know, it was a legendary game. It was a fantastic game, and obviously the build up around it and all the supposed bad feeling drummed up by the press. You know, I'd love to just get a look inside that. Was it as contentious as it was made out to be in the press? Obviously, you guys pulled out an extraordinary victory, which hurt and still hurts as an Englishman to this day. You'll be glad to hear, I'm sure. But just, if you can, give us a look inside that season, that game, and give us some perspective from the player's view, because every rugby fan thinks they know what that was like.
Yeah, I hate talking about the Grand Slam. In many respects, it's probably, in a funny sort of way, I don't know that it held Scotland back, but, you know, it happened almost 30 years ago. It's just ridiculous that we're still talking about it. And I mean that sincerely. I'm not trying to be funny or anything else about it. But the game itself, I mean, in those days, the Five Nations, there was always a team that was going to miss out every weekend or one weekend. And so England missed out the penultimate weekend. And we were not even playing for a Grand Slam before we had to go down to Cardiff and win that game. So we knew that unless we went to Cardiff and won the game, Scotland would not be playing for a Grand Slam. So I do remember we're good enough to win that game in Cardiff. And Jim Telfer, our assistant coach, alongside Ian McGeachan, said, right, no one's speaking to the press apart from David Soule, who, of course, was our captain, and the coaches. So we just all kept quiet. And, you know, of course, Will and the rest of the England team were talking about it in the press. And you know, they'll look back on that and say that probably wasn't the most sensible thing. But the fact was that you know, this was a year after the Lions tour. We'd gone down there. There were six or seven Scotsmen playing in the Lions test side. There were, you know, the same number of English guys playing in the Lions test side. And Scotland Fulham were a very competitive side in those days. And, you know, we were in no way thinking that England were going to come up as favourites or anything like that. So, you know, we were quite comfortable in our ability to win that game. And I never, and I say this 100%, that I never had any doubt leading into that game thought that we would not win it.
That really is interesting because that's you don't expect that answer because it was so close. I guess athletes at your sort of elite level have to think that way. But that the magnitude of that game on a domestic level was huge. I mean, I remember at the time I was a lot younger then, and I think these things tend to stick in the minds of fans longer than they do the players because you play another big game, and for us it was that was the big game that got away. But you mentioned the Lions tour then. Can you just talk a little bit about what a step up it is moving on and playing on a Lions team and a Lions tour? Because it's obviously different. But how, as from the player's point of view, what are the changes that you notice when you go on those big tours?
You know, I think the closest that anyone who is not a New Zealander can get to playing for a team like the All Blacks is playing for the Lions, okay? There's so much history and tradition around the Lions that it is, the fact that they do not play for 4 years. And then they pick a bunch of guys and you're called the team. And your job is to represent the best of the home nations. And it's an awesome responsibility. And I can only imagine that it is exactly like the All Blacks do the whole time that when they're there. And I reckon if the Lions played in a World Cup, they would be in the final like as often as the All Blacks are in the final. And I just think that that's you almost don't need to say any more because it's what the best of British and Irish rugby, and it's the best players, and we're playing against the best teams, and it's an awesome responsibility that you have to try and keep things going and all of this. So it's fantastic. It's brilliant. The famous jersey, you only ever play in that jersey. You don't have a second jersey, and you're playing against the best teams in the Southern Hemisphere, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand. So it doesn't get much bigger challenge than that, quite honestly.
Gavin, I completely agree with that answer. In fact, I would say that it's the pinnacle of British sport. Most of our sport has still got the home four nations, apart from some things like the Olympics. And the Lions is such an outlier that the way you said it, I absolutely completely agree with that. But I would like to say this. I don't know about anybody else here, but I'm slightly concerned now that you've got big money coming into rugby to reorganise it, and maybe it doesn't need reorganised. It certainly probably needs to be thought in a different way. But is there a risk that we're going to lose the Lions in the way that you've just described it?
In the short term, no. The Lions are guaranteed to tour for the next 12 years. I sit on the British and Irish Lions board as a former player, alongside three former Lions players and the chief executives of all the home nations. So it's secure for the next 12 years. And, I don't think we can look after beyond that anyway. There's no point in worrying about that. But, let's face it, if they didn't go down to Australia, New Zealand and South Africa, these countries would be very close to going out of business. The Lions bring in so much revenue for them that they rely very heavily on that revenue.
Gavin, can I ask one follow up on the Lions? Just as a fan, how we imagine when you pick these all star teams, you've got the best players in rugby, and how difficult can it be to make a team out of them? How difficult is it to put a team together in that short of a space of time and have them playing like a team, even with the talent levels we're talking about?
Well, that's just the challenge that the Lions have. And, you don't have any other way to do it. It's the time allocated that you have there. And, it's just that's the way it is. So everyone recognises that. it's probably this, you know, you've got this short time span of 6 or 7 weeks that you have to find a winning side. And it's the same sort of length of time as a World Cup tournament, if you like. And of course, the one difference being is that you don't have any time beforehand. You just have to rely on people's commitment to the cause and the desire to play for the red jersey. And, you know, by and large, the players really commit to that.
Gav, I know we've talked a lot about your career, the players that you've played with and now watching as a parent and watching as a broadcaster and media now with your board role with the British Lions. Question I have for you, of all of those people that you've known and played the game with, who are the greatest party animals that you've experienced rugby union with over the years?
Party animals? Charles, I don't know how you're levelling that at me, because I would know, because I'm always in bed quite sharpish, as you know.
Gavin, I know that's not true, because I remember one of your greatest moments of pride was when Jason Leonard posted his own all-time 15 for greatest rugby party animals, and I think you snuck in at number 15. So I just wondered from your point of view, who are the people that you've enjoyed touring with and over the years, because rugby has that great tradition.
Well, it does, and you know, but I'm getting on a bit now, Giles, and I kind of forget. I'm sort of forget an awful lot about what goes on and all this sort of stuff. But, you know, I think the people that you enjoy being with are clearly folk that they have the same common goals and the same common grounds and whatever else. And someone like Jason is great fun. He's a great bloke to be out with. But, you know, I think when singing is involved and people stand up and do their party pieces and just join in and really seek to get a party going. And I think, you know, you and I are a bit of a tough combination to beat in that score. You know, your piano playing has certainly come on a lot over the last 20 years, Charles, per se. And, you know, I like to always sort of accommodate you and sing my pub songs as I do.
Well, the good news is the Hilton Hotel here in Tokyo, I've discovered the grand piano, so we're in good place.
Excellent.
Gavin, I've got a superficial knowledge of rugby in the sense that I don't know it as well as you, but, you know, I love it a great deal. And, you know, I remember so well all those great Scottish teams in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. Can you tell me a little bit what you would look back on as the comparison between yourself and Andy Irvine and, you know, how that represented the evolution of rugby going from those eras?
Well, look, you know, there's a massive difference between what happened in the amateur days when obviously I played and Andy Irvine played and what happens now. And I love seeing people play with a smile on their face, and I love characters in the game. And, you know, Andy Irvine was probably the, you know, the golden child of Scottish rugby for many, many years. And, you know, he was just a very dashing and very exciting player to watch. And that was the way he played his rugby. And, you know, he was a great ambassador for the game and a great figurehead. And yet, you know, you drill down from there and Jim Rennick, who you already mentioned, is one of the great characters that you will ever, ever meet in the game. And, you know, I love bumping into folk such as Jim Rennick. He's because of his storytelling, and he's just a wonderful character. Finlay Calder, you know, was a guy that I played with for a number of years, and Finlay was just a strong, hard man, and you would go to war with Finlay Calder because he had that sort of gravitas and his ability to make people, you know, walk the walk with him and to really sort of, you know, push on beyond what they might have thought were their limits. And I have a huge amount of respect for Finlay Calder. And you enjoy being with these people. And as I said earlier, it's the people that you enjoy their company, when you enjoy their company, and that's what it's all about. And you know, you find kindred spirits in the Scotland team, you find kindred spirits on the Lions team, and you find kindred spirits in the opposition teams. And, you know, my only regret, of course, is not having been able to speak French, you know, for all the years that I played and even now, because I know that the French rugby players would be amongst those guys that I would maintain a good degree of friendship with. And I just think it's a shame that because of language barriers, we've not been able to form a friendship in the way that I know we would have done. So, you know, that's just
Gavin, I've heard you sing the Marseillaise before. I mean, with different words, to be fair, but I have heard it.
I know you have. That and a lot more besides. But, there's a lot of good guys in rugby, and, you know, a good guy is a good guy. It doesn't matter where you come from. And, you know, I think as long as these sort of values of rugby are maintained and are respected, then I think we'll be in a good place.
Gav, going back to going forward to this weekend on Saturday, so we have England versus South Africa. It's the World Cup final in Tokyo, in Yokohama, in fact. And England obviously put on a great performance. Just looking ahead to Saturday, what's going to happen? What's your prediction?
Well, if you go on last weekend's games, then you've got to very much fancy England. And I just think the manner in which they comprehensively outplayed New Zealand has got to give them the edge. And you know, if England have more in the tank, then it's very, very difficult to see South Africa finding a way to overcome just the strength of the England pack and also the nous of a George Ford and an Owen Farrell in the backs. And, you know, I thought Anthony Watson played very well the other day. Tua Lange was terrific as well. So, you know, it's difficult to see a way that South Africa can create holes in that England defence. But, you know, the beauty of sport, of course, as we all know it, is that you can never be 100% sure. It's not like going to a play and you know the outcome. And that's the wonderful thing about sport. That, yes, England will probably be favourites going into it. South Africa bidding to become the first team to win a World Cup, having lost a pool match. And, you know, it's a fascinating conundrum. And you know, I just think that that I want to see a great game. And if it's half as exciting, I think, as the New Zealand-England game last weekend, then we're in for a cracker. And, you know, and then we look forward to the World Cup in 4 years' time again. And, you know, but I think there's no doubt that it'll probably end up being a lot closer than people might think will be the outcome. And because of the intensity, the pressure of the occasion, and, you know, but England have got some real winners in there, and Farrell's a winner, Ford's a winner, Tua Lange's a winner, you know, the Vunapolas, the Itojis, they've got a very strong side, and, you know, this England team could be on the verge of greatness. You just never know.
Well, for me, as an Englishman, that's the perfect place to wrap this up, Gav. We've taken an hour of your time, for which we are incredibly grateful. One thing I will just note, I think you got something wrong there. You can't possibly have retired 24 years ago, because that would make me about 52. So I think I think it was about 7 years ago you retired.
Yeah, very kind and very funny. You're a very funny man.
Gav, listen, thanks so much for doing this. We can only apologize that you're going to have to spend some time with Giles over there, but we'll make sure he buys you a beer from us.
That's very kind. And Giles, I'll see you tomorrow evening at some stage.
I look forward to that.
All right, guys. Gavin. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you, sir.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Cheers, Gav. Bye-bye. Well, gents, I've got to say, wild horses wouldn't have kept me from this, even though I'm exhausted. But boy, am I glad I managed to stay awake for that. What a fantastic conversation.
Yeah, it's a joy hearing Gavin talk about the game. He's a great thinker of the game. And I think whilst it is 24 years ago since he retired, he's... He's connected to the game very strongly over his career. And I think people forget, and it's only when you hear a former great player talking about the game, particularly I find fullbacks, because they always have a vision of the game, because the game is always in front of them, is what a an exciting moment is happening within the game with the World Cup final happening on a Saturday in a sport that is, I think, in really rude good health right now. I think it's been a great World Cup. I think England beating New Zealand has really shaken things up for the good. And most importantly, it's a World Cup that has showcased itself for the first time in Asia, where two-thirds of the world population live on a time zone that's pretty different, certainly, to the traditional heartland of Europe. And if ever there was a chance for rugby to impress on the global stage in the fastest growing economies in the world, it's just done it. And I think it's the most exciting time.
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, I was critical of the World Cup in the pool stages. I think they got that wrong. I think it was too kind of haphazard, the scheduling. I don't know how they address that, but I'm sure they will. But say from the knockout stages onwards, it's been tremendous, and that's been down to the fans and the players, which is great to see.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the interview was fascinating from a couple of different perspectives for me. I love the stuff about him and his son and how he has, you know, that sending him away almost, that it was the making of him. I found that absolutely fascinating. And just in the last 5 minutes there, he talked about teammates and he said, you know, they've got winners. He's a winner. That one's a winner. And, you know, I like to always come back to the comparison of football. And, you know, a lot of the things we moan about in football, about, you know, people not working out in the dressing room, people not having that drive, whether it's a Dele Alli, whether it's a Pogba. You know, you listen to somebody like Gav and you see why some teams win and some teams lose. That's what I take away from it, guys.
Yeah, I think when you're a top level sportsman like that, I mean, you recognize winners, Rog. I mean, that's something you do. You know, you see these guys and they just have something about them. And I have to say, I think he's absolutely right. You know, you go through that England team, and there are a lot of winners in that team. And it's curious for me, you know, I think Eddie Jones will, when all this is said and done, get the credit he deserves for the way he's built this team over a period of time, and they've had a couple of sketchy performances, and you know the English press are brutal. As he was saying, you know, this week in the build-up, he said, you know, that the Kiwi press fate and adore the All Blacks and Steve Hansen. He said, you know, if I'd have lost the quarterfinal, I was out of a job, and so they do have to do it under the glare of a very critical press. But you know, he's gone about this very methodically. You know, he's built the players' confidence up. He's built them together as a team, and you know that's something that you can really see, Rog. You know, you and I, as football fans, you see these disgruntled players on the bench and what have you. Well, you know, with the England players, George Ford played superbly in the group games and was dropped for the Australia game. And there he was. There was no pouting. There was no stories in the press about unrest. You know, this is a real team that they've built together. And if you have a real team with half a dozen real winners in it, boy, they're going to be tough to beat next Saturday.
Giles, seriously, listen, you know, you say the game's in rude health. I'm not so sure. I thought that game yesterday, the Wales one, was as entertainment content as in the parlance, was pretty dire. I have to be honest.
But you see, this is where I take umbrage with you, is that I think sport can be entertaining, but sport should never be regarded as entertainment. Do you know what I'm saying? Is if you're saying,
I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying. I agree with you. I'm just saying you're farting against thunder there. That's my point, Giles.
Right. Okay. Can you unpack that, Rog, for want of a better phrase?
Listen, you know, we all know that none of us want to have our sports end up as content, as entertainment, as a franchise, as you know, all these kind of things. But to be honest, that's the way the world's going. Now, I keep coming back to this. We had the same theme with golf in the Open. And, you know, I had exactly the same sensation watching the Wales game. You know, and you know, I tweeted out the fact that, you know, I had my son there, who is the classic example. He did it as a favour to me to watch the semi-final. And he after 32 minutes, he said, "Dad, this is unwatchable."
Have you thought of sending him away to school?
Well, I did, and he actually went to a rugby school, and that's, listen, anybody who doesn't have in their household a child in that age bracket does not fully understand where sport's going. And you know, Gavin doesn't deserve this to be the tail end of the podcast because it's a wider subject, but that's the way it is, guys. The young ones are they look at it in a different way, and in terms of entertainment and content, and would the audience grow on the back of the Wales South Africa game? That is a resounding no.
Yeah, I get that, except I would counter that, which is because sport is not manufactured entertainment, and because you have to have highs and lows, as you do in life, Roger. Unfortunately, our children are a generation that expect always to be entertained, that always to have things laid on.
That's right.
When
that's
in
my
fact,
point.
You know, a bad game of test match cricket, when then there is a good one, it actually brings it to life even more so. So for me, the contrast of having a brilliant World Cup rugby match between England and New Zealand, which was scintillating, and then one which was effectively chess, mobile chess, actually brings into relief what makes sports so damn exciting, is that you don't always get something that is polished and glossed and kind of made in an esports studio, which doesn't necessarily create unscripted drama in the way that we need it to be. Not everything in life is perfect. That has to be.
I've got to say, I am with the man in the berry on this one, Rog, I have to say. But listen, you're right. We shouldn't make this the end of the podcast, because we're going to talk about this a lot more in weeks to come, I feel so.
It is the big theme. But my point I was going to make is this. It's not about whether rugby's in a good shape or not. My point is this. Given everything we've seen about values, about camaraderie, about building a team, rugby has got so many points over other sports, I'm thinking of one in particular, that I don't think they currently leverage enough. You know, if we all believe that the world is moving towards a much more value-based society, and that young kids are wanting much more from the brands they associate with, and you know, that's why Nike's moved in the direction it has, I think that's the secret for rugby. Rugby is almost unique in the way that there's incredible violence and incredible bravery, but then they come back with the kind of like humanity that is just beautiful. So football is a mile away from that. And you know, if I was, you know, advising CVC, I would be saying, let's get the best branding guys on this to make this one of our core competences that we want to communicate.
Well, Rog, that was, I mean, I agree with every word of that. It was spoken like a true consultant, I'm going to say, but I agree with every word of it. I think you're absolutely right. It has all that going for it. And we can only hope that the money coming into the sport does it more good than harm, because it would be a shame to see money spoil it. But look, guys, we have to wrap this up. Giles has places to go. I've got some sheep to count. And Rog, I don't know what you're going to do. Jump in the lake, maybe?
Yeah. That sounds a good idea.
All right. Good. Well, listen, gents, it was a lot of fun. For those of you listening at home, please, please, please do share the podcast with your friends. Subscribe to us, rate and review us. It all helps us tremendously. If you want to follow us, you can do that on Twitter very easily. You'll find us at EntertainedR. That's the word ARE. You should follow Gavin Hastings, who you will find on Twitter at 15 Gavin Hastings. And you can follow Giles. I'm going to tell you this because he doesn't know his own Twitter handle. It's at GilesMorgan71.
Well, he certainly doesn't know it today, let's put it that way. And you can follow myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Fellas, it's been a fun last 90 minutes. Have fun up in Tokyo. Give Gav our best and do buy him a couple of beers for me and Ross.
I will. Thanks, guys.
Cheers. Cheers, gents. Right, you ready? Everybody ready?
No, hang on. Guys, no, I'm not, because I've got this tapping in my earphones.
Metronome.
A metronome.
There's a triangular button in the menu bar next to the numbers.
We're cutting none of this out. This is the start of the podcast.
But James, what button do I turn this off with?
So you see the numbers counting up in the middle, top of the middle of the screen.
Yeah.
To the right of that, there's what looks like a purple button.
Yeah.
Yeah. Turn that off.
Got it. Done. Okay.
Yes.
Woohoo!
Yes, Captain Morgan.
Captain Morgan.
Right, I'm recording.
Are we ready?
Yes.
All right. Here we go.